EcoReport is a weekly public affairs program
providing independent media coverage
of environmental and ecological studies
with a focus on local, state, and regional people, issues, and events
in order to foster open discussion
of human relationships with nature and the earth
and to encourage you to take personal responsibility for living sustainably in the world.
EcoReport is produced by an independent team of volunteers
working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
And financially supported by listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to EcoReport. For WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Andrew Brown. A new study from the University College London finds that the Gulf Stream current is weakening. The Gulf Stream is an ocean current that brings warm water from the Gulf of Mexico to the coast of Europe, warming the continent. After cooling down, this water sinks deep into the ocean, going in a cycle across the Atlantic. Dr. Delia Apo, an author of the study, says that the weakening of the current started in 1850. A period of cold weather ended around this time, melting Arctic ice and diluting the salty water in the ocean. Because of this melting Arctic sea ice, the current began to slow down. Other studies confirm this weakening effect, including one which finds that it increases after 1950. This is linked to warming from climate change, which is also melting Arctic sea ice. In total, the study finds that the current has become 20% weaker than it was 160 years ago.
A recent report called The Future of the Sea predicts that the amount of plastic debris in the oceans will triple within the next 7 years. The report states that around the world, humans produce over 300 metric tons of plastic each year. Much of that debris ends up in the oceans. In 2015, there were 50 million tons of plastic in the ocean. By 2025, there may be as much as 150 million tons. About 70% of trash in the oceans is plastic. Rather than biodegrading, plastic breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces. The so-called microplastics hurt sea animals, pollute beaches, and contaminate seafood with hazardous chemicals. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a large accumulation of floating trash in the Pacific Ocean, is made up mainly of discarded plastic. The patch has grown to almost 617,000 square miles, about twice the size of Texas. According to the Ocean Cleanup Foundation, the area contains an estimated 1.8 trillion pieces of plastic weighing 87,000 tons. A new study published in Scientific Reports also says that 46% of the plastic is discarded fishing nets. The diet of sea turtles living in the area is as much as 74% plastic. Recently, a sperm whale was found dead in southern Spain. The animal had ingested 64 pounds of plastic debris. The necropsy revealed the plastic as cause of death.
On March 19th, the world's last male northern white rhino died, leaving only two females left to save the subspecies from extinction. The 45-year-old rhino, named Sudan, had been in poor health and was being treated for age-related issues and multiple infections. According to the conservation group WildAid, a veterinary team decided to euthanize Sudan after his condition deteriorated significantly. Sudan lived in Kenya, surrounded by armed guards in the days leading up to his death to protect him from poachers.
An international report found that the exploitation of resources worldwide is reaching a critical level. This is causing biodiversity loss and land degradation. These two issues threaten the food and water security of two-fifths of the world's population. The authors of the report, published by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, call it, quote, a wake-up call for all of us, end quote. Biodiversity is affected most strongly by agriculture, followed by forestry, infrastructure development, urban encroachment, and climate change. These factors are all harmful because they reduce the livable range for species. According to the report, hope lies in indigenous knowledge land use practices, which could be models for how to use natural resources for human benefit while protecting biodiversity.
While 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen, the actual supply of nitrogen available to plants is small. In order to become usable, it must go through a complicated process called fixation. A study from the University of California, Davis, finds that about a quarter of the nitrogen plants need to grow comes from bedrock. Researchers found that the ground supply of nitrogen changes by region. Places where there is a lot of rock weathering have higher amounts. This study explains the higher-than-expected levels of nitrogen in soil around the globe, a problem noted by scientists for decades. Kendra McLaughlin, program director of the National Science Foundation's Division of Environmental Biology, commented that, quote, "These results are going to require rewriting the textbooks. This discovery shatters the paradigm that the ultimate source of available nitrogen is the atmosphere," end quote.
On April 11th, the Environmental Defense Fund announced plans to launch a methane monitoring satellite into orbit. The goal of the project is to monitor industrial natural gas leaks around the planet and to make data on those leaks available to the public for study. Methane is naturally both colorless and odorless, making it difficult to detect leaks. It is also a greenhouse gas that is 25 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. Leaks are problematic at natural gas extraction points. However, the International Energy Agency estimates that half of industrial methane leaks could be fixed, quote, "at no net cost," end quote, since the amount of methane saved would cover the price of the repairs. While there are other methane monitoring satellite projects in progress, the Environmental Defense Fund is planning to be the most precise. The satellite is planned to launch in 2020 or 2021.
The Washington Post reports that Susan Combs was selected by Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke as acting secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. The appointment came after Combs' official appointment stalled in the Senate. She now oversees the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the endangered species it protects. Combs is well known to oppose protections afforded to endangered species. Stephanie Carroz, endangered species specialist at the Center for Biological Diversity, commented that, quote, "putting Combs in charge of the Fish and Wildlife Service is like appointing an arsonist as the town fire marshal. Combs will only work to strip away critical protections for our most vulnerable animals, not protect them," unquote. As the former Texas state comptroller, Combs successfully fought to take over the state's endangered species program. She used her authority to oppose Endangered Species Act protections.
Less than a year after the Trump administration ended Endangered Species Act protection for Yellowstone National Park's grizzly bears, Wyoming proposed hunting of the bears. The state will sell permits for killing 24 bears if they wander outside the boundaries of Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Endangered Species Act protections were granted to grizzlies in 1975, and their numbers increased in the greater Yellowstone area. Today, the bears are threatened by isolation from other grizzly populations. Loss of essential food sources and human-caused death, now including hunting. Currently, grizzly bears occupy less than 4% of their original U.S. range. The bears' mortality rates have been rising with a drastic decline in their traditional food sources, widebark pine and Yellowstone cutthroat trout. Drought and climate changes are expected to worsen those problems. Recently, the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission decided to bar grizzly bear hunting in that state. For WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Andrew Brown. We love to hear from our listeners. Contact us about stories we've aired, or if you have ideas for future stories. Please send emails to earth@wfhb.org. And now, it's Get Out and Hike, our segment showcasing the wonderful wild areas of southern Indiana and beyond.
This is Get Out and Hike, and I'm Jan Walker.
I'm here today talking with Marb Druin. He's going to talk about one of the trails in Brown County State Park called the Brown County No. 9. It's a loop trail.
Thanks for having me. The number 9's a really interesting trail. It is rated as moderate on the All Trails app that I've seen, but it's actually a very difficult trail. I wouldn't say very difficult, but if you are not used to doing high elevation or that kind of stuff, it is quite a thigh burner. From what I've come to understand, the elevation is very similar to something like the Appalachian Trail, so it's a very good place to train. My wife and I have been there twice now, and it is quite a challenge, but it's a beautiful place, and it has a really nice bench at the end of it, too.
Sounds like you need that bench.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how long is the trail?
It is actually, the full trail of it is 7 miles. Now, the thing that's great about Brown County is that you can combine trails, and the last time my wife and I went on the number 9, we actually took just the part that's the spur, and we combined it with number 8, which was quite a challenge, but it's a lot of fun. The spur at 9 actually ends and becomes a loop, and that's where actually the loop part pretty much kind of circles around, and then you go back again to the very tip, which I believe meets at Ogle Lake.
Okay. So when they come in the park, they can pick up a brochure.
Yes.
And the map is well laid out?
Yes, very well laid out. It's a very easy trail to find. It's at the very head of Ogle Lake. When you get to the edge of the lake, it's right there as soon as you get in.
So. Okay. And there is parking at Ogle Lake.
Yes,
so.
Plenty of parking.
Well, thank you, Marv, very much. That sounds like a trail that is could challenge people and really...
Yes, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This week, Norm Holy interviews Nicholas Zeroguinness on his research on excess energy emissions.
This is Norm Holy from WFHB, and today I'm interviewing Nicholas Zeroguinness. He's a scientist at SPIA. He's going to talk about excess emissions from coal-fired plants, what it costs the public.
Thank you, Norm. So the paper that you mentioned is some work that I did with colleagues from the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, David Koninsky and Alex Hollingsworth. So we looked at a specific type of emissions. The name is excess emissions, sometimes referred to as upset emissions. These are emissions of pollutants from industrial facilities that go above and beyond the permitted level of the facility. So each facility has a specific permit that regulates the amount of pollutants it can release in a particular year. Those limits are determined by the state environmental agencies. When a facility's emissions levels exceed those permits, and usually this happens during periods of startups or shutdowns or malfunction, sometimes even during scheduled maintenance, then those emissions are called excess emissions. And by definition, they are considered violations under the Clean Air Act. And just a clarification, our study looked at excess emissions across all industrial facilities in Texas, not just power plants, but across all types of facilities such as refineries, industrial organic chemical facilities, oil and gas fields, all sorts of industrial facilities. So what we found is that those emissions are very frequent. Those kinds of excess emissions happen almost on a daily basis. They are more excessive in times of natural disasters. In the paper, we give the example of Hurricane Harvey in August of last year, where due to the hurricane, many facilities in the state of Texas had to shut down before the hurricane and then start up again after the storm subsided. And because of those startups and shutdowns, we had about 2,000 tons of pollutants emitted into the atmosphere from all facilities in Texas. Apart from those extreme weather events, we see those kinds of excess emissions happening during routine operations of facilities. Texas is one of the few states in the country, along with Louisiana and Oklahoma, that keep detailed and comprehensive records of those excess emissions and make the information available to the public. What happens in Texas is that anytime any facility in the state has an excess emission event, it is required within 24 hours to notify the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, the TCEQ, the state environmental agency, required to inform the TCEQ on when the event started and give an estimate of the amount of pollutants that were emitted in the atmosphere and which pollutants exactly were emitted, and also what kind of actions the facility is taking to mitigate this event. Upon receipt of that information, the TCEQ, the Texas Environmental Agency, puts that information on its website, making it immediately available to the public. And then the facility has 2 weeks to provide an updated final report, sometimes revising the information it originally submitted. And again, that also becomes available to the public. So we obtained all of that information starting in 2002 from the Texas Commission and analyzed that data, and were able to gain a good understanding of which facilities were primarily responsible for excess emissions, how often those emissions occur, and their magnitude. And what we saw is that while those emissions are very frequent, the majority of them emit small amounts of pollutants. So the median event would release less than a ton of a particular pollutant. Events in the top of the distribution, let's say the top 5% of those excess emissions events, that can release large amounts of pollutants. And I'll give one specific example. In 2003, a power outage in a refinery in Port Arthur, in Texas, due to a lightning strike, several pollution control devices go offline. The facility emits within 56 hours 1,200 tons of sulfur dioxide emissions. That amount was twice the amount the facility released during the entire year from its routine operation. So we can see that within a very short period of time, and again, that's a sort of a, makes the point that those emissions, those types of emissions can have large magnitudes, can release large amounts of pollutants within short periods of time. And in some cases, those excess emissions are truly unavoidable, meaning that they are a result of something that could be considered as beyond the capacity of a facility to control. But in other cases, they are attributed to poor maintenance operations. They are attributed to human error. And that's when the TCEQ, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, comes in and investigates those excess emissions and assigns monetary penalties or takes other kinds of enforcement actions against those facilities. So Texas has a very thorough framework on how they deal with those emissions that other states have as well. However, this is a very policy salient issue for the following reason. For many years, those kinds of excess emissions had to some extent fallen outside of the regulatory framework of the Environmental Protection Agency, of the EPA, meaning that every state was required, because of the Clean Air Act, the main law regulating air quality in the U.S. So because of the Clean Air Act, they were, state environmental agencies were required to develop rules and regulations in order to try to minimize excess emissions from their facility. For many years, many states had in their state environmental rules language that would exempt facilities from being penalized in the event of excess emissions. Technically, those state rules were not in compliance with the Clean Air Act for many years. And for many years, the EPA was not able, either due to resource constraints, they didn't have the time, they didn't have the regulatory manpower available to push states towards compliance. That changed in 2011 when the Sierra Club filed a lawsuit suing the EPA and saying that, look, we have all those state regulations that violate the Clean Air Act, the EPA should do something about it. The agency, responding to that lawsuit in 2015, released a final action calling on 36 states to revise specific parts of their state environmental rules in order to bring the language that was targeted towards regulating excess emissions into compliance with the Clean Air Act. Currently, states are in the process of revising their state rules, responding to EPA's action in 2015 in order to eliminate some of those automatic exemptions that I mentioned earlier, that anytime an excess emission event occurred, as long as the facility could demonstrate that this was indeed outside of its capacity to control, there would be no enforcement action. So this is a timely issue from a policy perspective because things are changing as we speak.
Now, under the Trump administration, of course, the EPA has been pretty much gutted. So what's happened in this area with the EPA since Trump assumed the presidency?
So I think the status right now is that I'm not exactly clear on the details. I think there was a lawsuit on the DC Circuit Court pertaining to one case of those excess emissions. In response, the EPA requested that this lawsuit would be stayed because it would reevaluate 2015 action, asking states to revise their state environmental laws. So the EPA is now considering whether to change its stance on its request to ask states to bring their language, their regulatory language, into compliance with the Clean Air Act. So there is some uncertainty on how this is going to play out with the change in the administration since 2017.
Very interesting. Yeah. I've been speaking with Dr. Nikolaos Tsiroganis of SPIA. Your comments are very helpful. Thank you very much for the interview.
Are you looking for a way to take action on environmental issues? EcoReport is seeking volunteer reporters to contribute short headline news stories as well as feature interviews. We provide all the technical training you'll need. WFHB also offers internships. Give us a call at 812-323-1200 or email us at earth@wfhb.org. And now, we'll hear In Nature.
This is In Nature.
The morel mushroom.
I just like morels too much.
Mushroom hunting can be a wonderful, healthy outdoor experience to share with family and friends. But the thrill of the hunt is only half the enjoyment. Its deliciously earthy, nutty, steak-like flavor makes the morel mushroom the number one target of wild mushroom hunters across North America. Morels appear throughout the continent in spring. Trees are just beginning to bud, so relatively unfiltered sunlight warms the earth directly. This triggers the appearance of a number of wildflowers such as trillium, phlox, and violets. These flowers, along with temperature, are indicators of when to look for mushrooms. One thing we would like to do is to listen to morels. What? Morels have no sound? Well, let's see. Let's try this. That's for morels cooking.
You've been listening to In Nature.
This week in our listening area. Start Earth Week off with a beeline trail cleanup on Sunday, April 15th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. You will be collecting litter and removing invasive plants from along the trail. Trash bags and tools will be provided, but bring your own gloves and a water bottle. meet at the parking lot on Country Club Lane. Register at bloomington.in.gov/parks VOL.
There will be a guided tour of Miller Showers Park on Sunday, April 15th from 2 to 3 p.m. The tour will be an opportunity to learn about wetland ecosystems and urban wetlands. Learn to identify many types of animals and plants that inhabit a wetland and team up to build your own wetland model. Registration is at bloomington.in.gov/parks.
There will be a special family night paddle in celebration of Earth Week at Griffey Lake Nature Preserve. It will be on Friday, April 20th from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. Paddle out at sunset and watch darkness fall over Griffey Lake. Watercraft, paddles, and life jackets are provided. Bring a flashlight to help you navigate back to your car. Register at bloomington.in.gov/parks.
Come out and enjoy an Earth Day tree planting on Sunday, April 22nd, from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Griffey Lake Nature Preserve. All around the world, people are gearing up for Earth Day. This program will highlight the importance of reforestation and conservation of our native Indiana tree species. The program will conclude with a tree planting where you will be able to view proper planting techniques and tree placement. Register at bloomington.in.gov/parks.
Also on Saturday, April 22nd, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., there will be a mini film festival in the Tivoli Theater in Spencer, Indiana. The festival will be put on by Owen Putnam Friends of the Forest and will feature Earth Day films. And that wraps up our show for this week. Eco Report is brought to you in part by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
This week's news stories were written by Norm Holy, Linda Green, and Andrew Brown. Andrew Brown edited the script. Jan Walker produced Get Out and Hike, and Cindy Bolle edited the segment.
Kirsten Payton is our engineer and audio editor. Juliana Daly compiled our events calendar. Our producer is Rebecca Mueller. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Andrew Brown.
And I'm Don Guerra. Join us on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. after Making Contact and Fridays at 5 p.m. following the afternoon music mix for our weekly radio rundown of ecological news. You can also access headline news, feature audio, and our Get Out and Hike episode archive anytime on the WFHB website.
You've been listening to the Eco Report,
a volunteer-powered production of Community Radio WFHB
in Bloomington, Indiana.
Available for download and podcast at news.wfhb.org.
Eco Report is your independent, ecologically inspired news source
for South Central Indiana,
bringing you news that the Earth wants you to hear.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas
directly to the Eco Report staff.
The email address is
earth@wfhb.org.
That's earth@wfhb.org.